is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. A lot of news being made in the Pac-12 with the Huskies themselves, and we got to bring in an expert, somebody who can break it all down for us, tell us what it all means moving forward. And you read his stuff in the Seattle Times. UW beat writer right here with us, Mike Varell. Mike, how are you, man?
Can't complain. How are you guys?
We're good. We're good. We obviously saw the news. Larry Scott and the Pac-12 are parting ways, and I don't imagine, at least from my perspective on Twitter and seeing the text, not met with many sad comments. Nobody seemed overly upset about this move. Was this, in your opinion, a move that was you knew was coming? Did this come out of nowhere? How did you, when you heard this, what were your thoughts?
I was surprised on the timing. I think a lot of folks certainly thought that he could not be renewed past his current contract, but that is not up until 2022. So in terms of the timing of it happening yesterday out of the blue, I mean, that certainly took people by surprise. But like you said, you know, it was interesting. You have all these different differing fan bases and rivalry fan bases, UW, Oregon, Washington State, all these different fan bases. And the one thing they can agree on, it seems, is Larry Scott and wanting a new commissioner. So it felt like there was unity throughout the conference last night in that feeling, at least.
Well, Mike, tell us a little bit about your assessment of his tenure here. I know he was quite controversial, and I guess, you know, maybe if we lived in the South, we'd know who the SEC, you know, commissioner was. But it seemed like his name was in the news quite a bit. Just overall, the good and the bad things that stand out to you.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think what people forget now is that Larry Scott got off to a heck of a start where, you know, you remember, of course, as the Pac-10 became the Pac-12 right after his tenure, he facilitated that and the expansion of, you know, adding Colorado and Utah, which was certainly big for the conference. And then, you know, they negotiate a 12-year, $3 billion media rights deal, which at the time was a massive deal. It was the biggest deal in college sports. But things have really broken down over time. From a winning standpoint, they have not won a national championship in football throughout his 11 years here. They've made one men's Final Four in basketball during his 11 years here. They've really been lapsed by the field when it comes to that media rights deal. The Pac-12 network's been a disaster. The revenue has really trailed behind with their Power 5 teams. So it's a situation where he came in with a lot of steam, but in the last couple of years, it's just been kind of one mismanaged situation after the other, to the point where this was just inevitable. It was more of a matter of when.
Well, you brought up what a lot of people pointed to in the Pac-12 network, and the deal that didn't exist between the network and DirecTV was ongoing, and he was the guy that was pointed at as the reason that never got going. How big of an issue was that in this happening? Was that a big catalyst in him stepping down, or where did that not play a role at all?
I mean, it was massive, you know, in terms of how we evaluate that tenure, because he sort of bet on himself and bet on Pac-12 Network, saying we can do this by ourselves. And when you look at the other conferences, each one of them partnering with a legitimate network, whether it's ESPN or whether it's Fox, you know, whether it's the SEC or the Big Ten, no one's done it by themselves, and they've all cashed in because of that. And the Pac-12 Network, as we all know, has just sort of whittled away into what it is now, which is this limping shell of itself. So that is in many ways going to define his tenure. And, you know, it was a gamble, and it hasn't worked out for him. And obviously, like I said, he came in with a lot of steam, and some of those mismanaged situations have really cratered that and have forced a very necessary move.
And Mike, you talked about one men's Final Four in 11 years, not a national championship football team. How do you, when you look at the other conferences, you know, how can, if they bring in someone new, how can they positively affect that? How can they change the level or impact the level of competition in the conference, do you think?
I think what it comes down to, unfortunately, you know, you don't want this to be the case, but money really moves everything. And the reason that they've done this, or one of several reasons that they're having him step down a year early, is the fact that they want to get a new commissioner in who's going to be able to understand the conference and kind of get settled into his or her role and be able to negotiate a new media rights deal beginning in probably late 2022. That next deal is going to be absolutely massive in terms of how they can present this conference and make it attractive and make it marketable. And you get closer to the competition with a deal like that. You make more money, you have more revenue for each school. They can recruit better. Right now you have a massive problem in terms of letting recruits and great coaches basically flee east for better deals in the Big Ten or the SEC or the ACC. They need to retain their talent here to be able to win, and they can't do that without the money to actually be able to compete.
As far, before we move off of Larry, is there anything you point to as a success for him and say, hey, man, is for all the criticism he's taken, he got this done or he got this done? What do you point to as some of his successes, if there are any in your mind?
Really, like I said, I think it really is his first 2 years that he was there. I mean, there is a list of successes when it comes to the expansion of the conference. I think was a great thing, bringing in Colorado and Utah. You know, Utah, of course, has had a lot of success in football here. You know, the equal revenue sharing, they agreed to that for the first time in the history of the conference in those first couple of years. That original media rights deal for $3 billion, like I said, was sort of unprecedented, and it was the biggest deal in college sports at the time. The issue is that everyone since has lapped the field on that. But in the first couple of years, he made a very, very strong impression, and he just hasn't been able to maintain that. And that's kind of how the Pac-12 got into the position they're in right now.
Yeah, so John Wilner wrote about the committee that's comprised of Oregon President Michael Shill, Washington President Anna Marie Kaus, and then Kirk Schultz from Washington State. And he seemed to think that would ease everybody's fears, you know, as far as getting a new commissioner in here. Do you agree with that?
I wouldn't go all that way. I mean, there are a significant amount of fears when you're talking about a conference that is very far behind the pack right now in terms of national relevance. I spoke to all three of those university presidents today, and certainly they're sort of leading the committee here that's going to, you know, be conducting a national search for who the next person will be. And I do think that they're very capable. But there's no denying that there's ground to make up here. There's a very significant amount of ground to make up if you want to compete consistently with the SEC, with an Alabama, with an Ohio State in the Big Ten, with Clemson in the ACC. There's a lot of ground from a revenue and a prominence and a exposure standpoint that needs to be made up. And the first step towards that, the reason that there's hope today, is because they've made the right call, and the leadership is a very big deal. But finding a new commissioner is just one in many steps that are going to have to be had here for the Pac-12 to work its way back in the conversation.
Are there names being floated around that you're aware of in terms of likely replacement, or is that not even close yet?
Well, I think within the actual circles, it's probably not too close. But, of course, you know, right when this news came out, people thought, well, who would work out? Who would make sense? You know, Oliver Luck was a name that was floated immediately, who obviously has significant ties to the conference, who would make a lot of sense. But at this point, I don't think anything is legitimate. They're going to be hiring a search firm to help undergo the national search with the hope that when Larry Scott steps down in June, they'll have their new commissioner by then. But certainly at this point, there are names that are floating around, but I don't think any of them have actually been contacted or have gone through the process at this point.
Yeah, you know, what about, you've got Mike Kwiatkowski moving on to Texas, and I have some friends that are scouts, and that they talk all the time about just the money, Mike, that's spent at like places like University of Texas versus, you know, the Pac-12. And you mentioned money earlier, but, you know, is that part of the problem that the Pac-12, in order to compete, you know, you mentioned the money and everything, but also just getting fired up about people. I mean, I guess it's not fair to compare to Texas where, you know, the high school games are selling out in, you know, well, at least they were before COVID, you know, in stadiums. But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, other places, it just seems like right now, especially with the schedule this year, that the Pac-12 is having a hard time getting, you know, true fans really fired up. And then you're losing guys like Mike Wachowski to places like Texas. It seems like that will continue.
Yeah, it's absolutely part of the problem, Dave. And when you look at a guy like Wachowski, he was the highest paid assistant coach in the Pac-12. But with that said, he was only number 26 nationally, which really shows you the difference between investment in these assistant coaching pools in the SEC or the Big Ten or the ACC and then the Pac-12. And he lamented it. He was on the radio a couple of days ago, and he said, you know, he was asked about, you know, leaving UW and going somewhere like Texas and the difference, what appears to be the difference in fan support right now when you're in SEC country versus, you know, out west. And this is a guy who's from California, played at Boise State, has been in the West and in the Pacific Northwest for the entirety of his career. And he lamented it, and he said, you know, some places just seem to care differently at this point. And he wasn't sure how to get the Pac-12 back to that place. But it's definitely an issue right now in terms of waning fan support, both in, you know, game attendance and ratings and just in investment. And that's something that the new commissioner, whoever he is or whoever she is really going to have to try to address. But I think that it's obvious at this point that there just is not the same investment in college football in, you know, the West and the Pacific Northwest as there is in the state of Texas or Alabama or any of those places.
Hasn't that always been the case, though? I mean, as Dave brought up, they've got stadiums for high school teams. I mean, football is religion in Texas. It just is. And Alabama, they don't have a pro team. That is their pro team. And it feels like it's always been that way. Do you feel like the gap has just gotten greater?
Yes, absolutely. It has always been that way. But at the same time, the West has never lost recruits to the East and to the South the way that they're doing now, where every year the best players in the state of California, and in this case, of this year, the state of Washington, are going to schools like Ohio State or Clemson or Alabama and are leaving the West. There was a time where, you know, if UW wanted a kid, if they lost them, they'd lose them to USC. If you're in California and USC wanted a kid, that kid wasn't going anywhere. Now, you know, you have Emeka Ogbuka, who is one of the best players in the country, five-star wide receiver in Washington, and he's enrolling early at Ohio State. So the issue here is that I don't know if as many kids are playing football out west, for one thing, and I think a lot of those kids think that to have a real shot to go to the NFL, to play on the highest level, to play for a national championship, they've got to leave the West, and they've got to go to Ohio State or Alabama or Clemson, and that is a huge issue in terms of the talent disparity in the conference.
Yeah, and, you know, play at places where they play all 9, 10, 11 games instead of 5 or 6. And, you know, and obviously that was because of COVID-19. Mike, do you think when, let's say they open everything back up, do you think fans are going to come back the way, I mean, and not talking about Texas, but in the Pac-12, do you think that you're, Stanford's always, I mean, you know, I always like, oh, at halftime, everybody left to go to the library. That's when I played there. But, you know, they never could get a full stadium there. But, you know, Husky fans have always been very rabid. And, you know, how long do you think it takes to get back to that point?
I just don't think we have any way of knowing. And in talking to UW's president, President Kausay, today, she was very, very confident that, you know, that their fans missed the game, missed football, and that when this game came back, when the Apple Cup came back, she said she's very, very confident that it was going to be full, no matter whether it was at UW or Washington State. But there is a certain unknown there about how comfortable people are going to be in a stadium, whether that's worth it. They've already been dealing with, like you mentioned, you know, waning fan support at games, not as much at UW or at Oregon, but certainly at Stanford and UCLA and Arizona. Yeah. And all of these schools that have been struggling to draw for years now. And then you're adding 9 a.m. games, all these things. And the fan base has just become more disillusioned and apathetic over time. So they've been fighting a losing battle, and they've got to try to reverse that. And I think having some fresh blood, hopefully, in the conference and a fresh message from the top down, the thought is could maybe try to reverse some of that apathy.
Hey, last one before we let you go. And again, we're speaking with Mike Varela of the Seattle Times. Just in terms of the loss of Kwiatkowski for the defense, how big is that? Are we underselling what that means to this team moving forward, or what do you think?
I think it's huge, but we're about to find out, because the question for years, you know, ever since Kwiatkowski was at UW, it's been, he and Jimmy Lake on the same staff, and for a bunch of years they were co-defensive coordinators with each other. So if you want to do the chicken or the egg conversation about who the genius is, Pete Kwiatkowski was successful for a whole bunch of years in a row before he was ever around Jimmy Lake. And Jimmy Lake was also a rising star, obviously, in his profession, and is now the head coach. So Jimmy's going to get who he thinks is the right guy, and there's a good chance that he's going to be way more involved in the defense, and we'll see what it looks like. But Pete Kwiatkowski is incredibly respected both around here and nationally, so it'll be very interesting to see what UW's defense looks like without him.
He is. Mike Varell of the Seattle Times does a great job covering the University of Washington, also talking about Larry Scott will be stepping down as the commissioner of the Pac-12. So big news surrounding the Dogs and the Pac-12 in general. Mike, really appreciate you taking the time as always. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, guys.
There you go. Mike Varell again of the Seattle Times doing a good job covering all of that. And some texts coming in. Larry did jack bleep. when I was asking him, does he have any wins? What would you point to as the positives for the Pac-12 under his tenure? And they went, Matt Foley said he didn't do jack squat. So there you go. Another one. Good riddance. 4 years overdue. No love lost there. And then maybe they'll get a deal with DirecTV with whoever the new commissioner ends up being.
Whoever that is. Well, and again, he was kind of a flashy guy. You know, maybe people didn't like him personally.
Did you ever talk to him or anything?
No.
Ever...
You know what? He came in here one time, I think. No, that might have been, maybe it was the president. No, I think it was Larry Scott, and I think Jim gave him a hug.
Did he?
Yeah, it was because of the Pac-12 network, and it was really awkward, of course, as you
can imagine.
Of course.
Well, Jim's running his fingers through athletes' hair, hugging commissioners. Why not?
Yeah, but anyway. What, did I mute? Did I not mute something? Somebody says, explain to Dave what
they're,
muting
They're means. Referring to you saying that you weren't muted during the Mariners call earlier today on Zoom.
Didn't mute your video.
Yeah. I didn't know how to turn that off.
You turn off the video rather than the audio.
Well, somebody said snobby Harvard guy. I saw that, you know, Larry Scott went to Harvard. I mean, it's not very often you know that much about what the commissioner is of the Pac-12. I mean, I never knew who it was when I was at Stanford, the Pac-10. So, yeah. Who knows? But we'll see. It is kind of sad. I mean, talking to Brock, who did college football for all those years, he talks about the SEC and how for those kids down there in Alabama, you know, and down in the South, Louisiana, you know, it's like that's like pro football, like going to Alabama or Auburn or a school like that. It's like that's their childhood dreams is to play football for Bama. And he just said that there's a different level of commitment. There's a different level of, you know, fandom down there. As you mentioned, Bob, Alabama doesn't have a pro football team.
And that is their team.
That's their team. And it's like, in many ways, LSU and Alabama are professional football teams. I mean, the guys that come out of there, my gosh, those two programs. I remember at one point during the draft when you and I were doing that, I think they said that two teams didn't have LSU players. Mm-hmm. Like 30 NFL teams had LSU players on them. So, it's just a different level of commitment. You know, I don't know what it is about. Maybe it's the weather, you know, where people would rather go, you know, out to the beach or something than go to a UCLA football game. Stanford's never had a big base. Mm. It's a small population.
Yeah.
And look, I'll say there were people at Stanford.
Palo Alto.
There were people at Stanford that didn't think that that an academic institute should have
a football team.
So I'm there wasn't a lot of support there and that's just them individually. And I'm not sure how it is now, but it just, and I don't, there was lots of people that I don't think wanted it to be successful because it makes you look like you have a meathead, program, which I
seems inconsistent.
Totally disagree with. You know, to me, the football players, you know, I got my best grades during the season because you were forced to be, you know, disciplined and everything. So there's room for both. I don't know. It's just interesting, different parts of the country. And I think it's going to be, you know, kind of a little bit more of an uphill battle here, whoever's going to be the commissioner.
Yeah, USC had when I lived in L.A., Pete was the coach out there. There was no pro football team in L.A. That was USC.
Yeah.
There was a fever and a frenzy about that program, but even then, it was because they were great, and it was sort of the place to be. LA's kind of got that, you know, this is where I'm going to be seen. I don't think even at its height, it probably matched the way fans are just, it's a fever for Alabama. It's a fever for LSU, and in those schools out there, and even the Florida schools, and just it just is it's just viewed differently. It always has been, you know. Yeah. But I think the gap has gotten more as schools out here, as he points out, you know, no national titles for however long it's been. They just haven't been as competitive. So, and meanwhile, Alabama feels like they win every year. So it just right. you know that gap I think is widening. Between what happens out there versus, I don't know that it's a fair comparison if you're measuring, you know, the intensity of the fans. I don't know that they're ever going to stack up.
Yeah. Well, and then just the money. A few scout friends of mine have told me, like University of Texas, at least this was 5-6 years ago, that it was like you walk into their facility and it was nicer than any health spa that you would ever go into.
In which facility?
Texas.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then, you know, and there was actually a little bit of a knock on some of the Texas players that they were a little bit pampered because there was just so, you know, they just had the best facilities.
Imagine if you're probably in junior high, you're being recruited out in Texas.
Maybe.
You're probably, you know, treated, the facilities for junior high kids are probably off the charts in Texas.
Well, I remember talking to Moyer about it when Bellevue went down there and played, I think, Katy, which I believe is
in Katy, Texas,
Houston, maybe, in that area. But, yeah, he said that they had like a zero period that was for football that was basically another practice almost. So, like, before you went to school, it was like a chalkboard thing. So, they, you know, they would use that period.
As a class.
Yeah, as a class to put their offense and defense in. And, you know, so, and, you know, like he said, the stadiums, some of those two schools had their own that they shared that, you know, the capacity was like 15 or 20,000 people. They
for
filled
high
up.
School football
yeah.
game.
So, insane. And I think Bellevue might have gone down there and beat them.
Really?
I can't remember. Yeah, they had some impressive wins.
Yeah.
You know, they beat the team up here that was undefeated at CenturyLink. I'm trying to remember the name of that program. It was like in the North Bay of San Francisco. So, yeah, I mean, it's but the level of commitment in those areas, it's just going to be tough for whoever's the next Pac-12 commissioner.
All right, coming up, Jerry DePoto had some good news on the Danny and Gallant show this morning. We'll let you hear what he had to say. Coming up with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
The 5 o'clock refresh is brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, made to chill. Our thanks to Mike Varell for spending a few minutes with us talking Pac-12 and what's going on with the University of Washington football team, all of that. Meanwhile, Jerry DePoto was on with the morning show, Danny and Gallant, and they got to do a few different topics as, man, spring training is right around the corner. But some good news for Mariner fans out there that are eagerly awaiting the arrival of some of the youth we haven't seen yet. You're excited about the guys that are up, the Evan Whites and Crawford and Lewis and those guys. But two of the big names that we hear over and over and over, when are Kelnick and Rodriguez going to be here? When are they going to be here? Well, here he is talking about that.
We're going to have the same number of players in spring training for the Major League camp that we typically do, with the invitees. Among them will be Julio Rodriguez and Jared Kelnick. And, you know, we have to be as smart with how we assign them. We may be pushed into a situation where they are looking at a spring training that is extraordinarily long because there's no minor league season for them to go to. So we do want to be aware of the challenges that lie ahead.
So they'll be in the big league camp. I think the way they're doing it with the COVID situation, or COVIDs as some like to call it, it's going to be a big league camp and a minor league camp. They're not going to, they're going to be separate. Last I heard, and I don't know if anything's changed in that, but so they'll be with the big league camp.
Well, that will be very exciting. We heard yesterday when we talked to Shannon that Logan Gilbert, you know, is possibly pretty close to being up to the major league. So it'll be an interesting spring training. I just can't wait to see these guys. You know, we saw them a little bit in those scrimmages, you know, every once in a while. You saw Julio Rodriguez. He had a wrist, right? Did he break his wrist or something, Julio Rodriguez, last year?
Was it broken?
I don't know if he broke it or he strained it or something, but he had, by the way, for me not being able to remember that, it was De La Salle that Bellevue beat.
Oh, okay.
In the last segment, by the way.
Somebody texting
him. It was a hairline fracture in his wrist.
Hairline fracture. So, yeah, that's what I thought. But, I mean, look, this is really, you know, these guys are really exciting, and that's with, I saw J.P. Crawford today. He talked about his workout. I was on a Zoom call. And he was talking about his workout and how he put on a lot of muscle. So, yeah, it's going to be exciting to see guys like him. Was he your favorite? Was he?
He was my favorite.
He liked Evan White.
Yeah, I was just – what I loved about Crawford is that the knock on him coming over from Philadelphia was, yeah, he's a guy who can hit at this level. His fielding is really suspect. He's got issues fielding. So that's sort of
pretty
what
good
were,
to me.
Well, he worked with Perry Hill, and he turned into a Gold Glover.
Right.
And think about some of the – he's made some tremendous plays. I'm not trying to say he's the greatest shortstop in the game right now, but he's far from a liability. I mean, he's a Gold Glove winner, which isn't always a great indication. But, I mean, he's a decidedly better shortstop than anybody projected him being. And that's in a brief amount of time that he's been here with Perry Hill. So
I love his
just
arm.
Excited to see. He's got a great arm. He's got great range. I'm just excited to see what he becomes. And he's got to improve at the plate. He's not, you know, he wasn't killing it at the plate, but he just, you know, for that being singled out, isolated as the weakness, like, ugh, I don't know if he can play defense at this level. And for him to take the strides that he did, the steps that he did under Perry Hill, that's big. That's big. And having that kind of up the middle defense, and that's why I was asking Shannon about second base. Is it going to be Shed Long was their guy, but man, he didn't step up. So I don't know what's going to happen to him, if it's going to be Dylan Moore, but you need to be strong up the middle. And a big part of that is Crawford there.
Well, and they talked to, I can't remember if it was, you know, who it was. It might have been Kyle Seager. He was also on the call, Marco Gonzalez. But, you know, Marco didn't talk about it, but he was talking about Perry Hill and what a great job that he does. So, but, you know, and then in cut number 10, the talent, you know, from the first wave brought up has been pretty good too.
For the most part, we feel like the talent is there. They've grown. They're on the doorstep. That first wave, especially Kyle and Justice, like you mentioned, the first full season for J.P. Crawford, I think, was a positive step. We did see some positive developments in our bullpen. I mentioned the other day, Anthony Mashevitz, I thought was really good. Positive signs from Joey Gerber in his first transition into the big leagues. It gives us something to look forward to, especially as we lay in that next layer.
Mashevitz, we were told by Shannon to practice that one.
Well, yeah, there's that one in what's the
no,
other
she
one?
She was trying to get you guys to say, was it Margavicious?
Yeah.
Am I doing it wrong? You were going to call him Marge.
Yeah.
So that's a different guy.
No, it's Margavicious.
Oh,
Margavicious.
See,
I said
right
it
either.
The way you just said it.
Yeah.
I said Margavicious, and she says Margavicious.
So not only did
I heard DePoto on the radio with Rick Riz last year going, yeah, we don't really, he used an abbreviation because he didn't have it down either.
Yeah, she was saying Margavicious.
Every once in a while, you run into a guy who doesn't care.
Yeah, because it's like Mara. She doesn't correct anybody that calls her Mara.
Right, which I called her for the first 6 months.
Yeah, so
I don't care.
I think they get used to people saying, it just takes too much energy. Go, no, it's this. Yeah, they're just like, yeah, I know who you're talking to.
Whatever. Well, and sometimes you see people get indignant about it, and I'm like, well, why'd you spell it that way then?
You should have chosen a different spelling.
I'm joking.
One of the concerns that I've got with the team, I'm excited about the youth, but I've got questions about, A, the rotation, B, the bullpen. And the bullpen could be your concern every year because there's so much, you've got so much movement there. Guys in and out every single year. It's just, the Mariano Riveras of the world are an absolute rarity. You got guys who can close for a few years and invariably things happen. Edwin Diaz looked like you couldn't touch him when he was here. He was electric. You hated seeing the guy go. He goes to New York. They can't wait to run him out of town. He's terrible. Can't get anybody out. So it's such a weird role to have, and it is really a year-to-year thing. But Jerry DePoto talking about the bullpen, and he's excited.
We made a trade that brought in Rafael Montero, who has been quite good the last 2 years since transitioning to the bullpen. Keenan Middleton, who we picked up on a free agent contract. And we rule fived a young pitcher from the Tigers by the name of Will Vest, whose arm we really like and feel like he has a chance to be a difference maker. And, you know, let's not forget Andres Munoz, who we acquired last summer from the Padres. We anticipate getting Andres back somewhere in the first, you know, two and a half months of the season or thereabouts, and feel like that is an exciting back-end potential closer arm that will join our fray.
So excited about the potential. We'll see what it looks like. I mean, right now you don't have a guy you point to and go, well, that's the closer. That's the late inning guy. That's your late inning setup guy. This is your middle relief guy. Your long relief. They're going to determine all of that, and maybe it'll be stellar. I mean, it's just, if you followed the Mariners closely, we've seen years, even when the team wasn't great, where they 1 year had the best bullpen in all of baseball, and I believe it was the very next year, with a lot of those same faces, they were towards the bottom.
I remember that.
And yeah. It's just, you know, it's you can't predict it. So you just kind of live, in my opinion, you live year to year with your bullpen.
I agree. Yeah, and then, you know, like you said, I mean, you get a guy every once in a while that you throw him down there, and, you know, maybe he's a starter, and you say, let's make him a closer. He has some success for a year or two, and then all of a sudden, that's it.
Yeah.
He's done.
It's just, it's a weird thing, but that'll be the key, right? The pitching is going to be the key on this team. I don't worry about, we'll see what the offense can do. It was a little inconsistent, but you like the potential of your position players. The bigger questions for me surround the rotation as it sits right now without the youth up and the bullpen. So
yeah, I read yesterday, Marco, Justice Sheffield, Kikuchi, a little bit shaky, then Chris Flexen.
So you don't know much about him.
Yeah, don't know.
See him out there.
But then is it Justin Dunn? Do you eventually get Logan Gilbert up there?
Yeah,
I pull for Dunn.
I do too. I like him a lot, but he walks a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, so you like him, but do you feel like, oh, man, they've got a solid 1-2-3, 1-2-3-4. They're going to a six-man rotation. I know we're up against the break, but quickly, here's what Jerry said about a six-man rotation.
We loved it. And, you know, it was a choice we made, like you said, partly to battle the schedule and the fact that our players were coming back after multiple starts and stops. So our first thought was for player safety purposes. Could we build a safer environment by not asking our pitchers, our starters, to throw as often or, as we've talked about, ramp it up too quickly? So we brought them along slowly. Their first couple of starts were very limited in how many innings or pitches we were willing to let them throw. And you know, as a result, we were able to keep our starters healthy.
So like the way that worked out, we'll see what they do. But once you get past Marco, you feel pretty good about Justice, then everything else is a question mark for me. Got to see it. Got to see him do it on the field. All right, coming up, we're taking a look at the Seahawks free agents each and every day. We'll look at a handful of players, and Dave and I are going to make the determination. They're staying or they're going. We're going to do that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wyman and Bob present the Seahawks Free Agent Countdown.
Hey, let's go! Let's go!
A deeper look at the Hawks free agents and the implications of re-signing each one.
Once guys kind of earn their way with us, you know, and they become part of the spirit of how we do things, then they are always our guys. We got a little bit of a soft spot for our guys.
Now, here's Wyman and Bob.
It's a new segment we're doing every day, taking a look at the free agents of your Seattle Seahawks, of which there are 24 unrestricted free agents, and then again with a few with different designations, restricted free agents and whatnot. But just looking at those 24 each day, we take a look at a handful and determine they're staying or they're going. And yesterday we did three. Only one of the three made the cut yesterday. We got three more to look at today. So we've got a defensive end in Brandon Jackson. We've got a receiver in Josh Gordon and a safety in Demarius Randall. So Brandon Jackson, I think, is the guy that Pete, I felt, had an attachment to. You know how he talks about, he'll sing the praises of a guy you don't see much or is hurt or, you know, he's battling like crazy and boy, he can do this, that, and the other and wait till you see him kind of thing. I felt like Jackson was one of those guys.
Yeah, he's pretty versatile. And, you know, we've talked about versatility lately, but you kind of remind me of Quentin Jefferson.
Yeah.
Quentin, you know, was last year in 2019, he started at every position. And B-Jack was kind of that way. He's more of a defensive end, I think, maybe not quite as stout as Quentin Jefferson was. But yeah, I mean, he's a nice player, as you like to say. I mean, 3.5 sacks over, what, 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's going into his fifth year, and it's not like he's great, but he's also a guy that, you know, you want to have on your roster that fills it out because you're going to rotate your defensive linemen pretty regularly. So,
But he's got a physical issue.
The injury.
And here's Pete talking about that.
From the docs, you know, it's a situation where they don't recommend him playing this season, and he really came out of that episode okay, but it did, just in the testing and showing, it did show him that he had a physical kind of a trait that's one to protect, and so everybody's been convinced that the best thing to do is for him not to play this year. And I don't know that that's forever, but I do know for right now, and he's not injured right now, but he's susceptible.
He's not playing again.
Yeah, I don't
that's
think
that's
so.
My medical assessment based on what Pete just said there. He's got a trait, and they figured it's better for him not to play this season. He's not injured right now, so that tells me he's in that world. And I know every injury is unique, or every malady is unique. But you know, Cliff, Cam, Ricardo Lockett, they all had these different injuries that were related to your spine or your neck or something that could really be catastrophic if you're hit the wrong way, right? So it's just it sounded like that's where they're at, and I'm listening to that going, he's not coming back.
Yeah, it sounds like it to me. Time to get on with your life's work, because you just wouldn't take that kind of a risk. The other thing is he's a little bit older guy. He started later, but I mean, he's going to be 29 years old next season. He missed this last year, but it'll be just his fifth season coming up, 29 years old. So yeah, I would say he's probably not.
All right, before we got two more, and I want to get to some sound, but quickly back to, I mean, you're a maniac when you were playing. You'd had to have been dragged off the field, but had you been given news like that about an injury and they said, Dave, you're healthy right now, but all it takes is one hit, you're susceptible, you're vulnerable, how tough as crazed as you were to play that game, would you have had to have been talked into it, or do you think you would have heard that and said, all right, I'm good. I'm tapping out.
Well, I mean, you're talking about ending up possibly in a wheelchair.
Yeah, or you're talking about, hey, man, you're
total paralysis. Yeah.
You've got a condition that if you get hit, you're not like other people that don't have this. If you get hit, you could be looking at a wheelchair. You could be looking at.
And there's so many things that can happen on the field. And remember the Detroit Lion linebacker that was in like a halo it was like in the late 90s. And I guess he had a hit that was just like he ran into a guy's rear end, and it didn't even look that bad, but it jolted some nerve.
Was that Utley?
It wasn't Mike Utley, even though he was with Detroit. It was on a Monday Night Football game, and the guy, whatever the nerve was, it was his breathing mechanism or whatever, and he was dying on the field, and it was just a very benign hit. So yeah, you can get hit in so many different ways that I would be done.
Okay, Brandon Jackson, just by virtue of where he's at with his health, he's out.
Yeah.
Number two, safety, Demaryius Randall. Here's what Pete had to say about him.
Demaryius is a guy we saw, through the process, Arizona State, back in the draft times, evaluations. We thought he's a really, really good athlete and all-around ball player and had great speed. And, he's had a solid playing career. The film that you watch of him is really strong makes a lot of plays and covers a lot of ground, makes a lot of tackles, and he runs 4.3 something, so he has a great range back there.
So a guy that made $910,000 last year. Seahawks are just a little over that in terms of room left. They've got under $1 million according to the, over the cap or spot track or whatever you look at in terms of salary cap flexibility. So you got to – I think they got to be vicious in how they're assessing this. I mean, you're going to get, you're looking at veteran minimums. He's going to eat up that amount of money. Is he a guy? He's got aspects I like, but ultimately I can find versions of him all over the place
that are younger.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, he's a nice player again, but and he had experience and he's been around the league, played for the Packers and the Browns. He's got a couple of touchdowns that he's scored. Reggie Brown, by the way, is the linebacker from the Detroit that almost died on the field. But
did he end up being paralyzed or did,
no,
what came of that?
I think he had a halo thing and everything, broke like a bone in his neck or something, but it was more that his breathing mechanism was just shut off.
Jeez.
So, but Demaryius Randall, I mean, I think you can find a guy like this. He's going to be 29 next year. And you can find a guy like this in the draft that you're filling in, the rest of your roster with.
And then the last guy is a guy that I championed the entire time he'd been connected to this team. But unfortunately, it just feels like it's not going to happen, not just with the Seahawks, but maybe anywhere, and that's Josh Gordon. He'll be a free agent, unrestricted, but he's a guy that was removed from the list, the commissioner's exempt list, whatever it was, and then he was – that got rescinded because of something. We don't know what happened. We don't know if he missed a test, if he failed a test. Something went the wrong way. And you're talking about, the eighth suspension in his career? By all accounts, a great guy in the locker room. Teammates loved him. Coaches loved him. That's never been his calling card. That's never been his reputation, that he's a problem for other people, that he's a divisive figure, he's an attitude, a diva. None of that. It was about a guy with a disease that can't overcome it to this point, it seems. And you feel bad for people like that. You feel terrible for him. He's clearly not in control. And he's loaded with ability. We went through his history with the Browns, and in a year where he dominated ridiculous numbers, he's catching passes from Brandon Whedon and Jason Campbell
and Brian Hoyer is the other one.
On a terrible Browns team.
1,600 yards, 19-yard average, 9 touchdowns. Yeah, so that's the kind of talent he has, and yet...
This one's more you shake your head and go, man, that's a shame.
Exactly. Yeah, and I always say that your window is pretty short. I mean, by 30, you're an old man in the NFL, so... It's passing him by, which is very sad, and just wish him the best for, you know, him as a human being. And you hope, you know, after football, he finds something that will, you know, motivate him to stay, you know, stay sober,
stay the course.
Yeah. And, it's very sad. But again, you know, like he just seemed like a super sweet guy. Nice. Not hurting anybody else but himself.
Well, and to hear the coaches talk about him and to hear, you know, often if the guy's a problem, they don't say much. They may not throw that out there publicly, but you can tell when things are going on how a coach or other players talk about him. There was none of that with him, man. Guys loved him. They just loved him. So, sad story. Hopefully he can find a way to get things right in his life, but I just don't think we're going to see him anywhere.
I don't think so.
Not just Seahawks, but anywhere. So, 0-3 today. So far we've looked at 6.
Boy, we're tough, huh?
You got to be. It's cutthroat business, Dave. We got a budget we got to stick to here. So we got one guy.
Demaryius Randall's a UFC fan, though. Does that sway you at all?
That's right.
I'd still love to have conversations with him, but
we can still talk to him.
We can still speak. This is not a personal thing. This is not a we're not friends anymore thing. It's just you can't play for
we'll
this
see
team.
When we get to Greg Olsen after that Kings of Leon.
Oh, boy. Oh, don't do that to me. All right. So we've got one of six that's made it so far in our cut, should they stay, should they go segment here, right? And that was
Demontre
Moore. Yeah. And you sold me on him. I was ready to go for 6 here.
Yeah.
You sold me on his special team.
He's inspiring, man.
Yeah. All right. Coming up, we're going to talk some more football with the professor, John Clayton. He'll join us next here with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.